In the 18th and early 19th centuries, before it became a state, Louisiana was a colony of France and Spain and governed by their laws, including the system known as placage, in which white men and women of color entered into contractual agreements to set up common law households. That era is hauntingly evoked in Marcus Gardley's play, The House That Will Not Stand, which is on stage at the New York Theater Workshop on East 4th Street, where its run has just been extended until August 19th. Holla! I'm delighted to welcome the play's director, Liliana Blaine Cruz, and one of its stars, Harriet D. Foy, to our show now. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
So I got to tell you, the play was awesome. It just blew my mind to start with. And let's just talk a little bit about the background, and then I want to get down and dirty with some of the stuff. So the play takes place in 1813 on the eve of Louisiana's transfer to the United States. Liliana, how did Marcus Gardley come to write about this play and at this time period? Is it something about his own family history, or did he talk to you and work with you in rehearsals and tell you how he researched that era? How did it happen?
Sure. I mean, Marcus has family from Louisiana, from New Orleans in particular, and so I think it's a very personal desire to share part of that world's history.
Right.
And in relationship to like other inspirations, like the House of Bernard of Alba was also one of the influences for
him.
I did get a
sniff of that in there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So thinking about like this moment in history was really important to him and like what
that meant. Honoring the Creole side of his family.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, because, you know, it's a basic, interesting thing, but, you know, everybody that's African-American, there's all kinds of different parts of Africa. And then there's Creole. There's like, we're not a monolith. There's so many different ways to be a black person. And I, as a ancestor of, well, my ancestors were more from the southern area, not Louisiana, but like Virginia and stuff like that. I don't know that much about the Creole culture. Harriet, you play Makeda.
Yes.
Who works in the Albans household. Tell me about that family.
Makeda is their slave, house servant, and that is because she is of the darker hue.
Right.
She pretty much is the pulse of the house. She keeps everyone together. She knows all that's going on.
Oh, wait. You said she's a house servant because she's of the darker hue. That's already sort of a switch in slave culture where the house slaves were normally light skin, and the field slaves were the darker skinned ones. So how
everything's very different
everything
in New Orleans.
Is very
it's a whole other world
I
when
know.
You roll in. Yeah, the Creole.
Right. Right. Please place. Continue. I just caught that, and I was like, "Huh?"
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. So that was her state in life.
Right.
And she's trying to do anything she can to get her freedom. Everyone's on the edge. Stakes
right.
are high, and so from the time she wakes up that morning. If she ever goes to sleep, I don't think she ever sleeps.
I don't think she does either.
I don't think she ever sleeps. She's always on the go. She's everything to everyone. She's like the chameleon in the house. Whatever anyone needs, she becomes that immediately.
She really is, in my view, the matriarch of that family.
Oh,
she really kind of holds things together in ways that I think the actual mom doesn't. That was what I drew from her.
That's great, yeah.
Take
okay,
it.
I'll
use
take that.
It.
I'm going to use that tonight.
Let that change your entire performance.
I'm going to use that tonight, Nancy.
Can you tell us a little bit about the family that you work with?
Yes, there are three daughters, and Odette, Maudlin, and Agnes.
Mm-hmm.
And they are in the prime of their life, and they want to go to this ball. And their mother, played by Linda Gravatt, is Madame Beltrice, as I call her, does not want them to go and end up in the same way that she ended up.
Right.
Because she wants them to have something better. She does not want them to be a slave to a man who won't let them do anything in life. So she is very protective of them. And these girls want to go. So they're going to do whatever they can to go to this ball.
And you as a slave, but are you kind of owned by that family, or are you owned by the white man who is?
Well, and how is that?
Was
she was
thing.
Given as a gift to his Madame Beltrice.
Isn't that
so
something?
So this is, right, as so, a gift to help.
Right.
Because she couldn't possibly, you know, be bothered with raising the girls.
Oh, of course
so
not.
So someone has to raise them. So they kind of, that's why she becomes like their surrogate mother.
So that's another interesting layer of slavery
exactly.
that we, you know, we didn't know about is that this, that it connects.
And she also helps with Lazar's business, because that's how she learned how to read and do numbers and all that. So on top of everything else, she's a good businesswoman.
Right, right. It's fascinating stuff. But when the play opens, we see the house is in mourning, and there's a body of the man of the house, Lazar, is laid out. And what was, so his relationship
to Beatrice. As we said, that was the plissage.
Yes,
she
agreement.
Was a son. Uh-huh. Right. Yes. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So in the play in particular, Beatrice had fallen in love, or he had fallen in love with Beatrice,
right.
more likely. And
right.
so they arranged themselves to be inside of this contract. And so because
he's
of that.
He's already married, though.
He's already yes. married, exactly, to a white woman.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's how things went. Exactly.
That's how it is. Get the white wife, but, you know, I got to have blah, blah, blah.
Exactly.
Okay.
In town. And in town, Beatrice, you know, had this beautiful house because that's, you know, the system of their arrangement. And,
right.
But, like, I think in the play, you kind of hear how complicated that was, how complicated who he was as a person. And so, like, to kind of have him haunting, you know what I mean, his dead body laid out on the table the whole time, you kind of feel how his presence and how his personality impacted all the women.
It's true. And anytime you might not think about it, well, there he is, right there on the stage.
Yeah. And it's sort of like Beatrice is sort of like a slave or beholden to
yes.
him, because
yep.
at any point in time, he could cut her off financially.
Right.
And then what would she have?
Can you talk about that plissage, how that exactly worked? Was it a legal contract that sort of gave a legal heft to a relationship that wasn't a marriage? I mean, how is that?
Totally. Like, for example, in the play, Lazar has a will and he leaves all of his property to Beatrice, right?
Right.
So, like, in New Orleans, they would call it, like, the left-handed marriage, right? It wasn't necessarily property, you know what I mean? Proper
Whoa.
On the right, but, like, on the left, you know, you got your...
The shade
exactly,
marriage.
Exactly, the shady marriage. And, like, what was complicated about the moment of the Louisiana Purchase is that the laws... started to change. And so what might have been honored of this black woman owning property then changes when Louisiana is no longer under French control.
Oh.
So essentially, they're saying, no, black women can't own property. That property now belongs to the widow. And that's what creates all of this tension, because what would have normally transpired is Beatrice would have gotten all of this property. Her daughter's lives would have been secured for. Mm-hmm. She would have gotten all of this money. And all of that is now being like on the brink of being ripped away from her in the midst of this play.
Prior to the Louisiana Purchase, that plissage contract would have like gazumped a will that he had with his white wife? I mean,
well, I think
would they be two separate things?
They would be two separate things, but I think that there
but
was
But it
a
would
whole,
count.
It would count, exactly. And that's why there was this whole population of free people of color in New Orleans that existed, because people were able to maintain property and hold property. And so they had their own separate class simply because they were able to be bestowed mm-hmm. property through those relationships.
If I give you this, you give me this.
Ooh, mm-hmm. I want to write that on a t-shirt. Yes. I'm talking with director Liliana Blaine Cruz and actor Harriet D. Foy about the new play, The House That Will Not Stand, which is playing at the New York Theater Workshop. That's 79 East 4th Street. That title, that's ripped right from Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. A house that, you know, divided against itself cannot stand. And is this house divided against itself?
We have many things going on in there. Everyone is the stakes are high. Everyone has a plan, a plot, a journey that they're trying to make happen within this small night, this night and today. So,
right.
yeah, mm-hmm. Things are falling apart. Things are peeling away. We're losing things. And it's like everyone's holding on. Everyone's trying to survive.
There's also the pressure of how things can change.
It's
how
going
Louisiana,
to change.
Right.
No, it is changing.
Right,
so
right then.
It's when she comes, yeah, not, we don't want to give things away, but yeah, it does literally change. And she mm-hmm. says that. Yeah.
Now, okay, so Beatrice and Albons have the three daughters, and I think you said this before, but I just want to reiterate. Would they be his legal heirs under that plissage?
Yes.
Since they would have, they mm-hmm. had that financial stake
yes.
and stuff as well.
Right.
So, okay, so his death leaves Beatrice at this point, when we see that she's secure. Things are kind of cool.
Right.
But things could change.
Exactly. Well, she's waiting to meet with the lawyer who
right.
will then,
uh-huh.
like,
Monsieur
confirm.
Monsieur Pomeray.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Monsieur Pomeray, who will then confirm the transfer of property. But because these new laws are turning, because
right.
of the purchase.
That's right.
Exactly.
And now it's part of America.
Exactly. Like, all of a sudden, all the things that were true are no longer true.
And there
so,
they go.
Just
taking
like
black
that.
Women's rights away.
Exactly.
Because
right.
they were running
exactly.
the town. They built that. They built it.
Yeah.
When they got
mm-hmm.
there, they built that town.
Right.
And they
right.
were helping those men build those businesses, so that's how they became successful.
Now, Harriet, you have this, you have a couple of, all your scenes are amazing, but
oh,
you have
you,
this amazing scene where Makita is inhabited by the spirit of Lazar. You have to tell me, how did you, I act a little bit, how in the heck did you prepare to be a slave inhabited by the spirit of the white owner? How did you do that? You kicked that out of the park.
Oh,
how
thank you
did
so
you
much.
Do it?
And it was my greatest challenge, because this was new for my Makita part. I studied at the gym. I studied older Caucasian men.
You did.
I used some of them, and then I used some of my grandfather. I used to watch him all the time. God rest his soul, love him to death. And there was a thing he would do when he would eat. He always patted his foot, like if it was good. And I just always remember that, and just how they just curve over. I don't know. I just studied him, and then you know how you have your catalog of things in your character library, and I just started pulling them. And then I was reminded by Anthony Chisholm, who came to see the show. He said, "Remember you did a guy in Day of Absence a long time ago?" And I forgot one of the roles
that Douglas Turner Ward
played. Yes, and I played the minister. It was directed by Mary McClinton. So I was like, oh, so I've played men. I've been possessed. This is my career. What's going on?
Oh, my gosh.
But yeah, so I just go into it. And great direction from our director, Liliana, who just said, hey, think about this, think about that.
And did the words, together. Did the actual text at that point of in that scene, did those words help connect you with the tapping foot?
Absolutely.
With all of that?
The cigar. Absolutely. It took a minute to find him. You know, I had to work on it. And so once I locked in, I was like, oh, there he is. And it was, and I'm looking at the body on the, trying to you know, get some encouragement from the body on the table. I'm
right.
Looking at his face. I'm looking at him like, what was he doing? You know? So yeah, it took a minute, but thank you.
No, it was really successful. And you felt this.
And he's 72, and we talk about him. He's like
age.
A stray dog. How
yes.
does he eat?
Like
it's
a dog.
So it's all there.
It
he drinks
there.
Like a fish. So no, yeah, so you just have to put it together.
And you really inhabit, you bring this male energy on the stage, despite the fact that it's an all-female cast. Mm-hmm. What was that like to work with? Have you ever directed an all-female cast? Before?
I have actually. The last all-female cast I directed was for Colored Girls and Tazaki Shange's for Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough, which is one of the plays that like catapulted me into the theater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was like so wonderful to work with this all-female cast. And speaking of the possession, it's really interesting because in previous iterations of the play, Lazar got up from the table. There was a white man
Whoa.
In the cast. Right, which changes the whole dynamic. And I think Marcus's decision was so smart to be like, actually, no, let's focus on these seven women.
I agree.
You get a whole story about what does it mean to be possessed. Like the moment that Harriet found where, you know what I mean, his hands interact with her body. And you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah, creepy.
It's so creepy. It's
creepy,
terrifying.
Great, but creepy.
But you feel like, how somebody's spirit, you know, enters into a room, into a psychology, into, you know what I mean, how it creates damage in that way. And that, I thought that was so amazing. What was beautiful about being in the room with like seven women was just being in a room with seven women.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you talked about like how the Black experience is not monolithic. And
no.
You have, it's not, you know, and you just see seven completely specific, different experiences as actors and performers. And then they create such unique and beautiful individual characters and lives, and you're like, yes, it's so diverse, it's so beautiful, it's so specific.
It's wonderful.
And
it's a sisterhood.
Just, exactly.
With a sisterhood of house.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
And just also historically, for people who might not know, there were wealthy Black people.
Yeah.
Okay? There were wealthy Black people who were homeowners and business owners. There were wealthy Black people of different skin colors.
Yes.
And there were wealthy Black people of different skin colors, in some cases, who were also slaves of other Black peoples.
Right.
And had the same issues of skin color and hair that still, you know, happened today. The devastating scene where the one sister tells the other one, you know, you're dark, you don't matter and whatnot. Just watching, I have to just say, everyone, there was not a false note in that play.
Oh.
And certain scenes just really stood out. And watching that young actress's face change from joyous and giddy to just broken. Mm. And just all, it was an amazing thing. Amazing series of lines about color, which... yes, in some ways we need to get over, but we also need to really like talk about it and be aware of it.
Yeah, I was just saying there was a video that I was watching on Facebook with these young teenage girls, and there was a very brown girl, and the rest of the girls were different hued, and she was saying how she felt ugly. She's always felt ugly because she had, you know, natural hair, and they were trying to encourage her and say, no, you're beautiful. Look at your skin. Look at your eyes. Look at your lips and the way you look. And she was like, no, I've always felt this. Look at you guys, you know? And I was like, wow, this is already there, like in their teenagers.
Even,
so how do we do that?
Even young kids,
play?
Where
yes.
it seems like things are better than they, you know, than they should be, or more advanced than they should be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing 1 minute in my ear, and I'm like, what? Wait, we have way more to talk about. So going back to the title of the play, The House That Will Not Stand, and Abraham Lincoln speech. Is the playwright, do you think, talking about slavery or the family home when he talks about the divisions in the play or in that title or both? What's he going for, do you think?
I mean, I think it refers to all of the things. I actually think it's a quote from the Bible.
It is a quote from the Bible. That's right.
I feel like that's
a house
Marcus.
Divided against itself Marcus. Cannot stand. Yeah. Yes. I don't mean to throw it all at Lincoln, yeah. but
right.
yes.
No,
okay.
But I think, Abe. But I do think that there's something about, there's a civil war, and there's a civil war happening inside of this house, right? Like, there's a refrain that Marie-Josephine says, which is like, if you stab your sister in the back, the whole family will bleed, right? And that's like, gets repeated over and over again. And it's like, right, if we don't stand together, if we don't stand strong, then it's all going to fall apart.
Oh, I hate to say this, but I have to wrap. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Speaking
with director Liliana Blaine Cruz and actor Harriet D. Foy about their new play, The House That Will Not Stand, which is at the New York Theatre Workshop, 79 East 4th Street.